next speaker is one of our country's leading military historians. He began writing Forgotten Voices of the Blitz and the Battle for Britain. He wrote Operation Fortitude about the British spy operation ensuring the success of D-Day by fooling Hitler. He wrote The Secret History of the Blitz. Two of his books have been or are being made into major motion pictures, including Dunkirk, the Christopher Nolan spectacular number one films based on his book, and his latest book on the SAS, The Illustrated History of the SAS, gave him unique access to the SAS archives, which also meant he queued up in the nearby Costa for a cappuccino next to some of the most terrifying soldiers in the British Army. Ladies and gentlemen, Joshua Levine.
Thank you very much indeed. That is true, there is a Costa. So the SAS archive is in the Regent's Park Barracks, the Albany Street Barracks there. So the SAS Association is based. And it does have its own Costa there. So I was the only unarmed person queuing for coffee. Now, it's also been suggested to me that I begin this by singing Lili Marlene, which was a song, obviously a German song, which crossed the divide and became kind of a song of the SAS. I'm not going to do that, it'll take up too much of my time. So, maybe I'll finish with it. So, yes, the SAS, the Illustrated History of the SAS. So I was doing another book, in the middle of another book, when the Thank God Bishop asked me to do this one. And my instinct actually was, in fact, I did initially say no, because surely another book on the SAS wasn't necessary. There's been so much coverage in different ways. But I did start digging, and I found that so much of the story, as with so many subjects, well-done subjects, so much of the story actually has never been told. And many of the books have kind of copied each other. If you look, you know, you'll see a mistake. I got very friendly with a man called Mike Sadler, who was the navigator with the SAS, 103 years old now, in great health, and completely competent, fascinating man. And it had always gone down that he'd been in North Africa, but then hadn't gone across to Sicily because he had an ulcer. So I asked him about his ulcer, and he said, I never had an ulcer. And it's in all the books, but if you trace it back, it was first in the Padre's book, Reverend Klusky, in 1947. And there it appears and appears and appears. So that is how history sometimes is made. But anyway, I started digging, and I began by going to the SAS archive. I interviewed Mike Sadler, and I went to the National Archives. And that is where, almost immediately, I made what I thought was a really interesting discovery. In the archive, I found a file that documented the SAS's origins as a fake unit. Now, that's well known, it was a fake unit. And it came out of the mind of that great deceiver, Dudley Clark. Extraordinary, fascinating man. Really needs a good biography. And in early 1941, North Africa was just about the only place that the British were actually fighting, having evacuated from Dunkirk. And an Italian officer was captured, and with him was his diary. And in his diary, he wrote, the British have parachute troops here. And the British did not have parachute troops here. But Dudley Clark realized he would be pushing an open door by suggesting there were parachute troops. If the Italians believed it, then he could convince them easily. So he decided to create this fake parachute unit, which he called the SAS, the Special Air Service. And his central ruse, or certainly one of them, was to send two ordinary British soldiers from Palestine, where they were based, into Cairo, dress them up in fake uniforms, put parachutes all over them, and give them a script to deliver. So that's what's happened. They had these fake parachute badges all over them, and they were sent into cafes, into restaurants, and nightclubs, and cabarets. They were sent to the pyramids. They were sent to Cairo Zoo. And the idea was, people would come up to them and say, what's that? And they would, first, it was quite a difficult acting job. They'd have to say, I'm sorry, I can't tell you that. Oh, I can tell you a little bit, okay. And then they'd become garrulous, and soon the whole fake story was out. That was the idea. And they did it well. It was a success. They got Cairo and local enemy spies talking. And the Germans actually added this fake SAS to their list of known British units. So when David Stirling and Joliot set up the real SAS sometime later, their units simply assumed the identity of Clark's fake unit. So that's the story that's in the files, and it's really the story of those two men, those two soldiers sent from Palestine to Cairo. They interested me, because they were, in effect, the first SAS men, before the unit even existed. Now, one was called Smith, wasn't going to find him, but another was called Gurmin, G-U-R-M-I-N. He came from Wolverhampton, and he did so well in this mission, said in the file, that he was sent for officer training, and he was given a commission. He was an army lad, an apprentice engineer in Wolverhampton before the war. Suddenly he found himself an officer in the commando. So he'd risen quickly because of this. And I decided to do a bit of detective work. It wasn't really Poirot-level stuff. I googled Gurmin Wolverhampton. And up came a taxi firm run by Gurmin in Wolverhampton. So I phoned him, and he asked me where I was going. And I said, actually, are you going? He said, I am David Gurmin, yes. I said, did any of your father or uncle or anyone who served in North Africa? He said, yeah, my father was Mick Gurmin, this man, and he was in the SAS. I said, the real SAS? He said, yeah. I said, did you know about any sort of deception work, fake SAS work you'd done? He said, no, didn't know anything about that. So instantly, I had a story. His son had no idea about this. And what had happened was that Mick Gurmin had left the commandos and then joined the real SAS in late 42. So he joined all the legends, David Stirling, Paddy Mayne, these people, and they had no idea that he had actually been in the SAS before they had, because he wasn't allowed to say. He, in a sense, he was the first SAS man. And then I went to the SAS archive and found his photo album, which was full of pictures of his time in the SAS, but it also had these two photos of him in an odd uniform that they had no idea what it was. The SAS had never seen it before. And that, of course, was the fake uniform that he'd gone into Cairo with. And so that was just in a few days I found this, so clearly this was a book worth doing. There was going to be plenty of new stuff that was going to be found, and I did. I found many, many good stories, interesting stories, human stories. So the SAS was created. Jock Lewis, who I mentioned before, he was killed in one of the early raids. But the SAS was created and then owned, essentially, by two men who have become legends, Stirling and Paddy Mayne. But it seems, if you dig a little, they were both deeply frustrated men in a surprisingly similar way. Stirling had tried to become an artist in 1930s Paris. He'd gone out to Paris. He lived on the left bank. He'd become a sort of Rive Gauche artist, and that's what he wanted to do with his life. But he wasn't good enough. He had the creativity, he had the ambition, but his tutor out there told him, you're not good enough, you can't draw, you're not sufficiently good. He was totally devastated. He threw himself into, well, he became a mountaineer, into physical activity. He went totally away from that, decided he was going to conquer Everest. That's what he was doing when war broke out. And eventually that energy was sidelined into the creation of the SAS. Paddy Mayne, meanwhile, was a frustrated writer. He wanted to be a poet. He too didn't have the ability. And these were very different men in every other way. But one night on a drunken evening, they started out fighting, and then they opened up to each other about their respective frustrations, artistic frustrations, and they empathized with each other. And they admitted their failures, and it may not be an exaggeration to say the SAS was formed out of the artistic frustrations of two very driven and very unusual men. Again, enough. Well, of course, there was somebody else involved in the Second World War whose artistic frustrations, but let's not dwell on him too much. But the SAS, you could say, was formed out of this unusual alliance. And then, after a bit of a rocky start, the SAS started to do remarkably well, started to gain itself this wonderful reputation for striking behind the lines, for hitting enemy airfields. Became very well known by British soldiers, feared by Axis soldiers. It was a psychological golem, if you like, to Axis soldiers, who were scared of its sudden appearance out of the desert. They didn't know when or where it was coming, and a boost to the Allies. And the SAS people themselves, the SAS men, they knew it, and they started to grow quite pleased with themselves. And one day, Stirling and Fitzroy McLean were driving behind enemy lines. They were in their jeep, and they saw a truck over in the distance, an enemy truck, and they chased it because their jeep was faster than the truck. They caught up with it, and they ordered the two men inside out, and out came the men. And Stirling asked, "Who are you?" And in a foreign accent, one of them said, "We're the SAS." And so you can imagine how Stirling felt about this. So first of all, his unit has become so well known that the enemy's pretending to be the SAS. And who were they pretending to? The man who created it. Anyway, they were the SAS. They were the South African Survey. This was a unit that went around surveying the desert. And so not only was Stirling's SAS not the only SAS, they weren't even the first SAS in the desert. And that is, if anything ever was, a warning against hubris, that you can't... Thank you, I've had the 1 minute nod. So I'm pretty much going to end there. My point really is that you think you know a story, you think a story's been covered, but there's always more. If you dig, there is more, and it becomes more interesting and more nuanced. And that is a real lesson to everybody, I think. I mean, there are other stories I could go into. The Padre, who I touched upon, who in France parachuted in with the fighters. He parachuted in with an oak cross, a silk altar cloth, communion vessels, hymn books, and he went around various camps behind the lines with the Germans looking for them, giving open air services, and the men absolutely loved it. So, you know, there are all these fascinating elements to it. And I'll just finish with this. I can hang around. It's a wonderful thing, because when you get feedback from families and from people who were associated with the SAS, this is basically a history of the SAS that was drawn up and illustrated in a POW camp by Charles Bonington, who... father of the mountain climber, Sir Chris Bonington. And I found this in the National Archive in something else altogether. He'd done this as a POW. So Bonington's family had no idea it existed. But also, in here, you'll see he's drawn up an incident here where on a training run, basically an SAS man called McGonagall held up a train on the British side, held up a British train so that he would basically go to a training mission and get there quicker than anyone else. Nobody ever knew this had happened. McGonagall's family got in touch with me saying we didn't know this had happened, and we want to send this to his nearest relative because we'd like to blow up that picture and give it to him. He's a very old man now. And so when you get feedback like that, because you've been digging, because there's always more to find, then it makes a book that on the face of it, you might think, well, that's been done before, actually a worthwhile occupation. Thank you very much.